Hey folks, this is Scott Weingart, and you're listening to the MCRIT Podcast. Today, an apneic oxygenation update and a discussion on the new frontiers of pre-oxygenation. Why are we talking about this now? Well, because Nick Caputo over at Lincoln, along with his Lincoln Airway Group, has just put out the first randomized controlled trial of apneic oxygenation in the emergency department. I have been waiting for this one to drop because I was lucky enough to be a peer reviewer on this trial. So I saw it in its initial submission and I knew it was coming and I knew it was going to be a great study. Now, Rory Spiegel, EM nerd, critical care nerd, has just put out a post on this yesterday. So he's done most of the heavy lifting on the written description of the study and I highly recommend you check out that post. In addition to reading Nick Caputo's paper, you should read the accompanying editorial by John Sackles, which is fantastic and goes far beyond the editorial status to really being a review article on the current state of apneic oxygenation and pre-oxygenation. So if you read those three items, Rory's post, the actual paper, and Sackles' editorial, I think you will be in good shape to really assimilate the messages in this podcast. And of course, all of those things are linked in the show notes to this episode at mcrit.org/206. So let's get into the paper. I'm not going to recapitulate the entirety of its methods and results. Suffice it to say, they did a fantastic trial methodologically on the use of apneic oxygenation as provided by a nasal cannula in the emergency department. Now, all groups, the control and the experimental group, got fantastic pre-oxygenation, either with a non-rebreather at flush rate, and we're talking probably somewhere between 70 to 90 liters per minute through that non-rebreather mask, or BVM or BiPAP. All of these will provide high FiO2, probably well over 90% FiO2, and therefore provide good pre-oxygenation. And yes, their BVMs did have a one-way exhalation port. So all three of these possibilities all provided fantastic pre-oxygenation. And then in the apneic oxygenation group, they had on a nasal cannula also at flush rate. Now that is truly interesting because we had a Annals of Emergency Medicine article demonstrating the safety of nasal cannula at 15 liters. Now we have a randomized controlled trial demonstrating that it is at least safe in this trial to put insane rates through a standard nasal cannula. Now, we knew that through specialized nasal cannula, we could go up until 60, 80 liters per minute. Well, we don't know exactly what they were getting because these were non-calibrated flow meters, but they were well over 15. They were probably well over 40. They were probably well over 60 liters per minute through those standard nasal cannulae, and no one's head exploded. So that was the experimental group, and the control group just got the nasal cannula put in with no oxygen flowing through it. They provided a jaw thrust throughout to make sure that there was a patent passage for that nasal cannula gas to flow down to the glottis. And there was no real significant difference in the desaturation rates between these groups. Now, go to Rory's post to really see the nitty-gritty on this, but what was really interesting and pointed out both by Sackles and Rory was that neither group really desaturated because these patients were intubated very quickly, almost everyone within 2 minutes, but most much quicker than that. And the Cormack-Lehane views in these patients were remarkably good. I think almost everyone in the study was a 1 or a 2. So Sackles and Rory both point out that maybe this didn't test apneic oxygenation in the groups we really want to know, which is the prolonged or difficult intubations. But let's step back from that a second and ask the question that we all should be asking, which is, does apneic oxygenation work? And I think we could say pretty definitively it does in the operating room, especially when you look at the literature on these high-flow nasal cannulae, though we do have reasonable literature on just the standard nasal cannula at flow rates at 15, does seem to work in these elective operative patients. So then the question is, if it does work in those patients, why hasn't it panned out in now a RCT in a critically ill population, the similar trial, and now in an ED population, also potentially critically ill, which would be the Caputo trial? And so there's three reasons in my mind. And now the first reason was the one primarily pointed out by Sackles and Rory, which is that in the Caputo trial, at least, they didn't burn through their O2 stores, and therefore APOX wasn't really tested in many of their patients at all because We know from Benyamov's data that you could go eight and a half minutes in an optimal situation before you even start to desaturate significantly. So, you know, these patients who were intubated very quickly in both groups may not have exhausted their oxygen stores. And that is absolutely true. And that is probably the predominance of why we didn't see a result. But there's other reasons. The next reason is there something different about the Thrive, the high-flow nasal cannulae, because those were the robust studies? And maybe. I don't know, to be perfectly honest. We do know they're slightly larger bore in the actual thing stuck in the patient's nose. Does that matter? It might lead to less turbulent flow of those high flows of oxygen. But this is interesting. This is an area we really don't understand. And if you think you do, then do a little experiment. Don't stick a nasal cannula in your mouth at 60 or 80. I think badness will ensue. Just do it at 10 or 15. Just take a nasal cannula at that rate and stick it in your mouth and try to close your mouth and see what you feel. And what you're going to feel is that if you don't open your mouth and take that nasal cannula out instantaneously, you will probably rupture something in your lungs. You cannot sustain 10 liters per minute going into your mouth for even more than a second. Try it. Don't try it if you're going to blame me when anything bad happens. But if you really want to understand why I think we don't understand this stuff, then try that experiment. And you can extrapolate from that what 60 liters per minute will do. And yet, we tolerate this in our nose, no problem. 10 liters, 15 liters, and now in the Caputo trial, I'm much higher than that in the nose. Well, then it's quite obvious that most of this flow is not actually getting into your system. Because what that would mean is if someone on high-flow nasal cannula closed their mouth, they'd get that same rupture of their lungs. And you could do that experiment as well. Put a nasal cannula in your nose at 15, or if you're brave, put it up to 30 or 40 liters per minute and see. Close your mouth. Feel what's going on. Now, it's going to be drying to your nose, but you will not feel like your body is going to explode. So something very different is going on. Now, I had mentioned maybe the Thrive nasal cannulae are leading to a different flow pattern than the standard. I don't think so, but we don't have information on any of this. If you want to do a great kind of pseudo-bench study, then get a bunch of healthy volunteers, like folks like Groombridge and Hayes-Bradley have done, and stick in standard nasal cannula at 40 liters per minute, 60 liters per minute, 80 liters per minute. Stick in a Thrive nasal cannula at those same rates. Stick a pressure gauge in the patient's mouth, or the volunteer's mouth in this case. Stick an FiO2 probe in the back of their throat, and let's see, is there an actual difference between a Thrive nasal cannula and a standard nasal cannula? What pressures are they actually generating? Because remember, we know from the Thrive data, they're generating like 2 or 3 centimeters of PEEP. Well, I promise you, if you stuck those in the mouth and tested the pressure, it's going to be far higher than those 2 or 3 centimeters. But I would like to know, is there any difference at nasal cannula at 15 versus a nasal cannula standard at 80 versus a Thrive at 15 versus a Thrive at 80 in terms of the oropharyngeal pressure and oropharyngeal FiO2. We don't have that information. But I'm really spending too much time on these first two points because the third point as to why AppOx hasn't panned out in the two critical care trials, the reason in my mind, which is physiologic shunt. Now, neither Rory nor John Sackles mentioned this explicitly when discussing why the ENDOW, that's the name of Caputo's trial, didn't pan out. And I think this is the major reason that you're not going to see an easy effect of AppOx in a sick population. All patients in the emergency department getting intubated probably have some degree of physiologic shunt, meaning there is blood flow going through non-ventilated alveoli, and therefore you're getting direct mixture of your venous blood with your arterial. And that's going to diminish your oxygen saturation regardless of apneic oxygenation, because the apneic oxygenation can't touch those alveoli. So you're going to get this admixture. Now, the sicker the patient, the more physiologic shunt they're going to have, especially if that sickness relates to a direct pulmonary cause. But, I mean, it gets even worse, and we've discussed this on the podcast. Any patient with hemodynamic derangements will have a multiplication of the effects of that physiologic shunt because they might have diminishment of their mixed venous oxygen from increased extraction in the tissues. So if you have a patient with poor cardiac output or a patient who the intubation itself has generated poor cardiac output, whatever degree of physiologic shunting they have is going to be multiplied by the now diminished PVO2, the venous oxygen saturation, because what's mixed is now even lower than it was before. Well, as a result, depending on the degree of physiologic shunt, the patient's shunt fraction, will be how ineffective the Apox will be to fully prevent desaturation. We don't have this data. I think it would be fascinating to be able to stratify patients for efficacy of apneic oxygenation by some surrogate of their degree of shunt just prior to intubation. I mean, what we'd really want is real time during the intubation, but that's going to be hard to get. What we could get is a blood gas on their 100% or near 100% FiO2 pre-oxygenation. So right before you push the meds, if you had patients with arterial lines and could draw an ABG and send that off, that would give us a very interesting piece of information. Because on a patient with high FiO2, their AA gradient would be a reasonable representation, not a perfect one, but a reasonable representation of how bad their shunt is. And I am willing to bet that a patient with a really poor AA gradient will have a less effective apneic oxygenation. Now, can we fix this? It is my belief we could. And that would be with the provision of apneic oxygenation in combination with apneic CPAP. Because then we'd have the potential to prevent derecruitment. If you have CPAP pre-oxygenation as well, then you might be able to eliminate that shunt. So in addition to reading Rory's paper and John Sackle's editorial, add on to that the concept of physiologic shunt as the barrier to the efficacy of apneic oxygenation in the ED and critical care unit. Now, I'm going to have Nick Caputo on to discuss this paper and future projects. So if you have questions for him, put them in the comments on this episode, and I will ask him those questions. Now, that is the discussion of the apneic oxygenation paper. Let's talk a little bit about where my mind is going on pre-oxygenation. And again, read Sackle's editorial to hear where his mind is going. And they're probably very close to the same destination with some slight alterations. Now, I've been thinking about this a lot because we had this kind of Twitter war with a gent named, at least his Twitter handle is @PatientSafe3. And he is another one of these rare breeds that just really has, and I don't think he'll be upset at me for saying, just a really evil presence on Twitter sometimes, and yet is delightful when speaking to him in real life meat space. And I've had some fantastic conversations with this gent. He's an anesthesiologist from Australia, and we've really been probing each other's soft points on pre-ox, on reoxygenation, all these things, and we'll probably co-author a paper together. And that paper will probably be the redo of the Annals of Emergency Medicine pre-oxygenation paper. And so I've been thinking about this a bunch. I created new lectures based on it. I just want to share some of my new ideas with you folks and hear what you think. So the question that comes out of the Caputo trial is, should we continue putting a nasal cannula on patients for ED intubation? And Sackle says yes, Rory says yes. They say it because they think apneic oxygenation probably still has a role for prolonged laryngoscopy, and I agree with them. But there are more reasons. So I would say definitively, the nasal cannula should be on, and it should be on at least 15 liters per minute. It probably should be on more, but I'm going to leave that up to you because we don't have fantastic safety data on it, though the Caputo paper would give us some indication that it is safe to knock that up to flush rate on a standard nasal cannula. But you do what you feel best. But at least 15 liters. Put that on the patient. And then put on a non-rebreather mask on the patient at flush rate, meaning as high as your flow meter will go. It is marked on the side of every flow meter what their flush rate is. Yours better say at least 60. It's usually going to say 70 or 90 on it. Unless you're in Australia. And in Australia, it seems they are limited to like 19. You're not going to be able to use your non-rebreather in patients in Australia if that's the flow meters you have. And Sackles advocates, and I thoroughly agree with him, that we should have better flow meters in the ED. They should be calibrated, not just flush rate on the side of the flow meter, but calibrated up to something like 70 or 80 liters per minute. Those are available, and those are what we should have. So now you have a nasal cannula on high flow. you have a non-rebreather on high flow. On that high flow and the non-rebreather should be the max flush rate that the flow meter will go. We have now a few studies demonstrating that a non-rebreather at flush rate provides very high levels of FiO2. So that's nice. And you might say, why am I still advocating this nasal cannula in addition to the preox? I intimated there were other reasons, and here they are. It prevents the leak of BVM of having a major effect on the patient's delivered FiO2. So let me say that again in a better way. If you have a nasal cannula at least 15, preferably more, underneath a BVM mask with a slight leak, the nasal cannula will ameliorate the effects of that leak. So that makes it worthwhile. Now, it's interesting, and at Patient Safe 3 will not be happy unless I point out that a nasal cannula at less than 15 will give a small leak that will not be fixed by the oxygen it's delivering. So if you're going to stick a nasal cannula underneath, you better make damn sure it is at high flow rates. Number two, the nasal cannula at least 15 allows the provision of apneic CPAP when used with other devices. I'll get to that in a couple of minutes. But suffice it to say for now that without that nasal cannula, no device except maybe a Mapleson C circuit will provide apneic CPAP in the way you want it provided. So I still, even if Apox was definitively shown not to be beneficial, would still probably have it on for those two reasons. And then the third reason is for apneic oxygenation. If your patient's saturation with that high flow nasal cannula and high flow non-rebreather is not 100%, I would advocate switching your pre-oxygenation to something capable of providing CPAP. Now, I'm pointing this out because this has been my personal practice for a while, but we didn't put it in the paper. We didn't put it in the paper because A, we have no proof for this. It is really based on what I consider to be good practice. It's based on physiology, but it is not based on good data yet. But we've been advocating, if you can't get them up to 93 to 95%, and I think the final rec in the paper is greater than 95%, then put them on CPAP. But what you're really saying on a patient sitting somewhere between 95 and 100 is that their PaO2 is, you know, hovering around that 80 level, but I'd rather that PaO2 was hovering around that, I don't know, 300, 400, 500 level. That would be a lot nicer. So for me, when I can't get them up to 100, it's telling me they do have physiologic shunt because all the other causes of hypoxemia pretty much disappear at those FiO2s. And I will usually provide some form of CPAP pre-oxygenation to those patients. Again, not great data for it, but it's probably what I'd recommend to you as well. If you do not have 100% sat with a non-rebreather, switch them over to something capable of providing CPAP pre-oxygenation. I'll tell you what those devices are in a moment. So now, either I have 100% from the non-rebreather, or I've put them on a CPAP pre-oxygenation device to try to get them as close to 100 as possible, and I will take those devices up to 15 centimeters of water PEEP in order to try to get them up to that 100%. And now, and this is a big diversion from what I've previously recommended, I would say they need at least 3 to 4 minutes of denitrogenation using those high FiO2 devices. At the point where you are up at the head of the bed, or the intubator is up at the head of the bed, and you are right about to push your induction and paralysis medications, there should be a switch. This is new. This is not fantastically data supported. So I always give that proviso. But this is my current recommendation to you. At the point you're about to push the meds, you should switch off that non-rebreather to one of four devices. And I'm going to read them off, all of them, and then I'll discuss each one in a little more detail. Here are your four options that should be switched to the patient's face right before you push the induction meds. A ventilator with a BVM mask. An oscillator. A BiPAP machine with a BVM mask. Or a BVM with a PEEP valve and a pressure gauge. All four of those options should be in concert with the nasal cannula at least 15 liters per minute and end-tidal CO2 hooked up to those devices. All of those devices will allow end-tidal CO2 to be hooked up. Now, why am I recommending one of these four devices? Well, these four devices all do some things in common. They allow either pressure monitoring or pressure limiting of every breath provided with positive pressure. So they are either pressure limited or pressure monitored. And remember, my BVM had a pressure gauge on it, which is how it becomes capable of that. They are all capable of providing near or at 100% FiO2. And they are all capable of delivering PEEP. Those characteristics, I think, should be on the patient's face right before you push the meds. This will allow a few things. One, it will allow you to bag the patient safely, and bag in quotes here, because some of them are doing breaths, but not bagging per se, but you understand what I mean. They all allow safe provision of positive pressure breaths during the apneic period. And this has been a move in the anesthesia world. They call it modified RSI. It's been a move in the real thinkers and movers and shakers in the ED and critical care intubation world. Levitan's been saying it forever. We put it in our paper. John Sackles mentions it in his editorial. I think even Calvin Brown in the new iteration of the Walls Airway course book mentions this. So all of us are recommending this now, but you got to do it safely. And I don't think it's safe to do it with a BVM without a pressure gauge. We find, even with a pressure gauge, that you have to remind the person providing the breaths that they're in the red zone. If you don't know what I'm talking about, just go to the show notes and I'll show you a picture of my BVM. Now, let's go through them one by one. A ventilator with a BVM mask will provide perfect breaths every time, high FiO2, adjustable PEEP, really perfect. And to make my friend at PatientSafe3 happy, it also will monitor if somehow there's been a screw up with the medical gases in the wall, and it will tell you, it will alarm if the FiO2 that's being provided to the machine is screwed up or it's gotten disconnected from the wall. This is my vision of the ultimate device for both pre-oxygenation, apneic oxygenation, and reoxygenation in the ED, is a ventilator with a BVM mask. But, you know, some people are going to find that too difficult. I think as we advance, we should just move to understanding these ventilators, and therefore it won't be difficult because it provides really beautiful pre-oxygenation. It provides beautiful CPAP for pre-oxygenation, and it allows you to reoxygenate patients safely. But that's a choice. The oscillator, and if you don't know what I'm talking about, go to the oscillator show I did with Jim Ducanto. But this is a idiot-proof vision of a BVM. You could set maximal pressures. You cannot exceed them and therefore can't give these high-pressure, dangerous breaths. The flow is fixed at a very nice, slow flow rate. With an adapter that you could just leave on at all times, you could provide PEEP with it, and you can really master this in a way much easier than the ventilator. BiPAP is obvious. Again, it could be providing mandatory breaths. It could be providing pressure support and PEEP with high FiO2. I like to have the BVM mask hooked up to that BiPAP circuit rather than the BiPAP mask when I'm just about to intubate, because this allows me to hold the two-hand mask seal and then take it off easily without having to take those straps off. And then the BVM with a PEEP valve. The PEEP valve preventing any entrainment of gas at the exhalation port, even if set to zero, and a pressure gauge hooked up to high FiO2 with a bag reservoir, as Sackles so astutely points out in his editorial, that the corrugated things kind of suck. And any of these four with a nasal cannula underneath them at least 15 and end-tidal CO2 hooked up will allow the safe and verified provision of positive pressure breaths during the apneic period. And therefore, since we are now planning to do this, it should be there before your induction, even if you use the non-rebreather to provide your pre-oxygenation and denitrogenation. Okay, a lot there. Curious to hear what you think. The last thing I'll talk about is end-tidal O2. Now, you guys are all familiar with end-tidal CO2. You never should be doing an intubation without end-tidal CO2. I think it's unacceptable in the ED or ICU to not have that. And that doesn't mean color change. That means waveform capnography. I think it's unacceptable to deliver a breath through a BVM mask or an supraglottic airway without that device on, much less the endotracheal tube. I think any breath delivered in the ED or critical care at any point for any reason should be with end-tidal CO2 monitoring. But end-tidal O2 measures the exhaled fraction, the FeO2 of oxygen in that exhaled breath. It will give you an idea of whether you've adequately denitrogenated your patient. And now, this just requires a definition of my vision of these terms. I think preox in general is a shitty term the way it's currently used in the anesthesia and ED literature because it doesn't really tell you what you want to know. And in our paper, Rich and I separated denitrogenation and preoxygenation. We said denitrogenation is how much of your alveoli is filled with oxygen rather than nitrogen, and that is what end-tidal O2 measures. And then preoxygenation is best measured by an arterial blood gas, a PaO2, but with a surrogate of that being your saturation. Not a necessarily good surrogate when 100, but a reasonable surrogate when less than 100 to tell you you haven't done enough. But what we want is both. We want a fully denitrogenated patient, represented by the end-tidal O2, and we want a fully preoxygenated patient, best represented by a beautiful PaO2 on a blood gas, but we'll take 100% sat because we don't have great monitors to do something better right now. And I want both, and that's why I separate out those terms. You could have a patient with a reasonably shitty oxygen sat who's still maximally denitrogenated, and vice versa. You could have a patient who is satting 100%, and has done really nothing good on their denitrogenation side. So you really want to monitor both of them. So the question posed to me repeatedly and in somewhat belligerent fashion on Twitter and then in very kind fashion in my subsequent exchanges with that patient, SAFE3, is that every intubation should also have end-tidal O2. And this I'm not sure of. I mean, what I will say is this. If I could have this poof, you know, wave your magic wand, and I'm sure all of you have them, and every intubation now has that information on a little square on their monitor screen, would I think that would be a good thing? No cost, no opportunity cost. It's just there. The magic of patient safety has led you to now have those numbers. Should you look at them? Definitively. Absolutely. It's going to prevent very rare errors like medical gas screw-ups, like things getting disconnected from the wall and somehow you didn't hear the change in volume on your BVM. So for that reason, and also because maybe it will give you a better spur to fix your preoxygenation and denitrogenation if you haven't already picked up on it. But obviously, that's not. There is no magic wand. And so the question is, should we mandate this like I am in whatever limited power I have mandating end-tidal CO2? Well, as it stands now, most of the end-tidal CO2 monitors in the ED do not have the provision for end-tidal O2. I was lucky enough for 10 years at my old place, we had a mass spec as our end-tidal CO2. That's essentially what they use in the operating rooms as well. And so I had end-tidal O2, I had end-tidal CO2, I had end-tidal sevoflurane. So I had this number. It didn't really change my practice much because for the most part, with the provision we were already doing, we had them up as high as we could get them. Sometimes we wouldn't have them high. You would usually on these devices shoot for 90%, and we just couldn't get them up there. And so we tried different stuff. We'd put them on higher flow. We'd switch them over to BVM, and we still couldn't get them up. There's just some patients that won't come up. And therefore, it never changed my practice. I never had it allowing me to recognize that the BVM wasn't hooked up to oxygen. I'm not saying it can't. It certainly could if that ever happened. It just didn't happen. We checklisted our intubations. So things were checked. But maybe it could provide it. Now, the question is the opportunity cost of replacing your monitors, spending that capital cost, getting them to now change your monitors to ones that have that, is it worth it? I don't know. I'm not saying it's not. I'm just saying I don't know. And I'd love to see patient outcome data as opposed to simply number data demonstrating that. And when I say number data, it's like, okay, well, this number of intubations in the ED had a 85% end-tidal O2, and we were able to get it up to 90 with these actions. But that's great, and that would be an interesting study, and I'd love to see it. But does it make a difference? I don't know. I mean, here's the Apox stuff. It didn't seem to make a difference in a group of 200 intubations. So I don't know if I would advocate a demand for end-tidal O2 like I would for entitled CO2. What I would say is I don't think it's technologically unfeasible for every device that gives you entitled CO2 for the manufacturers to just make them devices that measure both. And if that is possible, and if we demand it and they do that, then every time you replace a monitor, it would be crazy not to get one
that had
entitled CO2 if there wasn't a significant price difference. And even if it did cost $1,000 more, in terms of the cap cost replacement cycle, I would happily pay that $1,000. Now, should I just rip out my existing monitors because they don't have it? Probably not right now. John Sackles mentions the standalone device. I think that's a huge burden to add into your intubation procedure from your standard monitors to add in now a separate device. I think that just would also have opportunity cost in terms of your mental bandwidth of setting up an intubation. But I will continue to debate this with my friends, and maybe we'll come to a more conclusive recommendation shortly. All right, we've run long. I like to keep these at 20. We're at 30. I know this has probably generated some controversy. I love controversy. Put them in the comments section, mcrit.org/206. Scott Weingart for the MCRIT podcast saying bye-bye.